Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. And we have something really special for you today. Last week we introduced you to Esther Perel. Esther Perel is back with us to talk a little more about sex and sexuality. Esther, welcome back to WBAI. People don't know
pleasure.
It. But that was a re-recording, so you were here, when was the last time you
about
were
here?
About
a year ago.
About a year ago. And you've had some travel since then. Esther has written a book. The name of the book is?
Mating in Captivity.
And the Mating in Captivity is translated into 17 different languages.
21.
20. I knew. I told you were going to say
it. With a new subtitle for paperback. The paperback release just occurred in the U.S. A couple of weeks ago. And the new subtitle is Unlocking Erotic Intelligence.
Because unlocking erotic intelligence relates to what originally brought you to this whole thing.
Yes.
Right? And that was the an article. Let's tell the story. I think it's an interesting story because Esther Perel probably is the world's leading authority on sexuality. And I won't say sex. I'll say sexuality because I think that's more more descriptive of the way you see things. So what happened? Tell us how this all took place, Esther, because it's a fascinating five-year trip you took.
Because we are in 2002, even actually in 2001, and we're still talking quite a bit about the Clinton scandal. And at that time, I was quite intrigued by the response that the United States had towards the dalliances of its president, which stood in sharp contrast with how France at that point was responding to Mitterrand being buried and having his wife and his mistress there with his legitimate and illegitimate children. And I wondered why was the United States so more comfortable with divorce and rather intransigent toward infidelity or adultery when other societies often have actually shown more tolerance toward infidelity and less so towards divorce. And then I went to a professional conference and I met the editor of the Psychotherapy Networker, Rich Simon, who said, well, what are you thinking about these days? And I just blurted out, I'm thinking about Americans and sex. He said, why don't you write something? I said, because it makes for great dinner conversations, but I'm not sure that I could produce a clinical article with that would be coherent and cogent. Anyway, I gave it a try. I wrote for a whole year. I did 11 versions of that article and really began to actually articulate my thinking about culture and sexuality in couples as I see it today and what are the dilemmas of desire in modern couples. And particularly, what is the paradox between domesticity and eroticism, our quest for security and our need for adventure, and the fact that this is the first time in history that we're trying to reconcile both in the same place. I wrote the article. The article began to have a whole life online and in the professional world, but it got picked up as part of the Best Erotic Writings 2004 and then on the cover of the Utney Reader. And from there, the agents, and from there, a proposal that led me to 14 interviews with just about every major publisher in town. And that's when I began to understand that there was something probably in the way I think about it and the fact that it was counterintuitive and rather different from most of what had been said or is often being said about this subject that led to mating. And then Mating in Captivity translated into 21 languages in 1 year lets me think that maybe it wasn't just a book about Americans, but it actually, you know, put its finger on what goes on with desire and the problems of sustaining desire in long-term relationships worldwide.
And it seems to be the problem of sustaining desire, you call the dilemma of desire. What happens to desire with couples? I mean, what happens is, you've been all over the world now. You're 16 different countries you've traveled to, and you're...
Right.
Where are you going this week? You're going
Paris, back to Paris.
What are you going to be doing in Paris?
I'm doing a major television show that's called Taboo. That's on French 2 channel, which is the second largest channel in France, or maybe the first. And it's a show on masculinity, manhood and masculinity. Evening show, an hour and a half, primetime television.
It would be quite something. So you're excited about this, but they're going to be bringing you. But
from here.
How are you going to be able to talk to the French people? You're going to get a translator?
No.
You're from France originally?
Yes. No, I'm from Belgium, actually.
You're from Belgium.
The Flemish part of Belgium, and they'll make fun of me because I have an accent, but I will show them that content supersedes accent.
Boy, have you ever seen, have you ever done any of this in Amsterdam?
Yes.
Quite a difference, isn't it?
I did a lot of radio and TV and newspapers in Amsterdam.
Do you find that difference and that difference with the openness and the attitude is very different in Amsterdam compared to France and
but
other places?
But you see, you think that because Amsterdam is a liberal society and open to prostitution because of the harbor and open to marijuana because of its legalization, that it actually translates into the intimacy of the bedroom. And you forget that the Dutch are quite Protestant and not necessarily very hedonistic.
The Dutch are not hedonistic.
No. They come from a very Protestant tradition, agricultural land, flatland tradition. And when I go to Holland, they talk to me as a Belgian, as we are much more, you know, Catholics have a better way of transgressing and being sinful and then going to confession and making up for it. There is more pleasure, there's a traditional view that Catholic societies in some way, certainly Latin Catholic societies, are more pleasure-bound than the Protestant Stoic ones.
Well, that's interesting. When you say pleasure-bound, does that mean that they move more towards sex as their pleasure than do people who might move more towards farming as their pleasure? Building a home?
It means that when you eat in Holland, you get just enough to sustain yourself. And when you eat in Belgium, you get a full plate of food. That was the traditional view of it. There was a sense that pleasure comes with excess. Pleasure comes with permission. Pleasure comes with idle. Pleasure comes with non-productive. Pleasure comes with playful. And that's all elements of the erotic. And that is what is often referred to when one looks at a more... when you say pleasure-bound, you're not looking at sex per se, but you're looking at movement, you're looking at physical touch, you're looking at the amount of physical contact that two people have when they have a dinner, and you compare Mexicans with French with Americans, for example. That's one study. And all of these things intersect with each other.
So if you have excess... with sex, that's sensuality. And if you have economy with sex, you would say that's more the other way of being, right? Is one more passionate than the other?
No, I think actually that when you talk about desire, you really talk about the continuum between both poles. In the realm of desire lies a whole world of excess, and in the realm of desire lies also a whole world of economy, actually, of less is more.
And give me an example of less is more.
That often desire is rooted in absence and in longing. That you can only want because you in some way don't have. And you cultivate the wanting through the not having and through the longing for it and through the soliciting of it. That's one definition of desire, which is why one of the questions of mating in captivity is, can you want what you already have? Or is desire rooted in absence and in longing and in not having? On the other side, there is also a way that desire is not just needing to not have. It can have and it can lavish itself in the having and relish itself in excess.
Well, okay. So
and it is afraid sometimes from actually doing too much. You know, sometimes people are not having desire because they're afraid to bring the full force of their desire to their partner. The excess of it, the fact that it is not proper and calculated and contained.
Well, if it's not contained and you bring the full force of it and your partner says, ooh, that scares me, right?
Then you hold back.
Then you hold back and you look elsewhere?
Sometimes you look elsewhere. Sometimes you just become more inhibited. Sometimes you go into your own fantasy life, your own feverish daydreams.
You truly believe that you could keep passion alive even with couples that have been together for many years?
Yes, but I also always think that it ebbs and flows. I don't think that desire is ever sustained like that. I think that it's like the moon. It has intermittent eclipses. But couples who have a spark are couples who know how to resurrect it, how to bring it back. And when you talk about passion, you talk about a general intensity in the relationship, a quality of aliveness, of vibrancy, not about a frequency of how often they have sex.
Esther, there seems to be more and more research, both with neuroscience and hormonal research, that suggests that people are more responsive sexually, passionately at one time than at another time. For example, I know of people who have said, you know, if it's right after my period, I tend to be much more romantic and much more sexual. And if it's in the first 2 weeks, you could find me that way. By the third week, I'm starting to go downhill. And the fourth week, I'd rather have a conversation. You know,
mm-hmm.
Do you believe that these hormonal changes do make that big a difference?
On arousal, yes. On our imagination, no.
What's the difference?
I think that when you talk about desire as being a consequence of arousal, of a physiological arousal, then you will locate it in the hormonal changes. Absolutely, people's hormonal changes will elicit arousal. But desire doesn't always follow arousal, and certainly women know that very well. Often the arousal follows desire. Often first you get into the experience, and then comes the desire for it, and then comes the excitement that accompanies it. It's not linear. So to just think that it is neurobiological is reductionistic, but you can't make abstraction of it. Yes, when you are turned on, it comes more easily, but you can also be at the third week and suddenly somebody actually turns you on through the conversation that you're having with that person. There's a way of eliciting the mind and turning someone on and making them attentive that is a very different pathway and that can be just as beautiful.
So you're saying that the person with full intention, since the hormonal changes are primarily associated with the female, right, with the woman, that a man, if a man is wooing a woman and he's got the intention and he has the passion and the desire, it doesn't matter what phase she's in.
And she needs to be willing to be wooed. She does need to give herself the permission. She has to at least be willing to not close herself off and make him be the custodian of desire. But yes, I think that failure of desire is often a failure of the imagination. And I think that many women who walk around with low sexual desire often actually have low desire for the sex they can have.
Custodian of desire. It happens frequently, and I've seen it. One person becomes a custodian
right.
of love, the other person doesn't. One person becomes a custodian of desire, the other person
Correct.
Doesn't. One person becomes the custodian of economy and finances, and the other person doesn't. So often between couples, one person assumes a role and the other person abandons it.
But you can only abandon it because the other one is assuming it.
Right.
See, that's
the point.
It's a convenient split.
And sometimes it's a convenient, it's more than a convenient split, because sometimes, you know, you give up on trying to prove, like, fidelity. There's one person is in charge of the fidelity and the other person is not. There's one person who's always jealous and always questioning, and the other person's not always jealous and questioning. But it's like sometimes becoming too responsible for one aspect of a relationship, the other person even abandons their opportunity to get involved. Sometimes you can't get love when another person is too loving.
But that's why when I say convenient split, what I'm saying is that you can defer to the other person. You can let the other person enact a part of the relationship, enact a set of needs that you have also, but that you no longer are claiming, because the other person is doing it for you, and then you can complain that they're doing it poorly. But you can only not do it because the other person is actually holding it up. The moment the other person stops, you will see how the roles interchange. These are complementary arrangements that couples get into, in which each person kind of dumps their vulnerability onto the other person, and one person's predilection matches the other person's vulnerability.
You know, Esther, there's so much. Our guest is Esther Perel. Mating in Captivity is the name of the book. New title for the soft cover book is Rediscovering Erotic Intelligence?
No, it said Mating in Captivity, but it used to be Reconciling the Erotic and the Domestic, and now it's Mating in Captivity, Unlocking Erotic Intelligence.
Mating in Captivity, Unlocking Erotic Intelligence.
Mating in Captivity, it will stay forever. It's unbeatable.
Yeah, it's unbeatable, pardon the expression. If you have, two things I want to cover with you. One is, in all your travels, there's a focus that each country has, each group has, each nationality has. Are people very different sexually? I mean, is it really, when it gets down to the bed, are the Swedish people and the French people and the Amsterdamians, the Dutch, mm-hmm. and the Americans really that different in bed? I mean, can a woman who is traveling from... I was just reading about this thing about women traveling to Kenya. I'm sure you heard about that, the convenience of sex in Kenya.
I thought it's Cuba.
No, it's now moved on to Kenya. But if... Is it that different? Are they different? Are the lovers different? Are the French lovers different than the Swedish lovers and the German lovers? Than the Are they really that different, or is it all the same? When
look, it's a very pertinent question for me. I traveled these 16 countries, and I speak 9 languages, so I was able to quite often enter much more deeper. The first place where I would look at cultural differences would often be on the subtitle of the book. The French subtitle is Making Desire Live in the Long Haul.
Good.
You could never put the word desire on the cover of a book here.
Why is that?
Because that is not an American term. Americans talk about sex. They don't talk about desire.
Mm.
The Spanish people put how to cultivate passion or something like that, because even if you wrote a book about Heidegger in Spain, you would still need a self-help title. But the Italians called it Reconciling the Erotic and the Domestic. The Brazilians had a fabulous subtitle, Dribbling Past the Traps of Marriage. So they put soccer and sex on the cover, and they had their two national preoccupations. So the subtitle and the cover that was chosen in each country was quite telling about how the culture narrates sexuality. But the general narration of sex, the particular fodder for the imagination, what are the particular standards of beauty, what are the fantasies du jour, those may be very local. But the problem of desire, the wish to be desired by the person that you go with every night, the wish to be able to let go with somebody who can withstand the force of your desire, the wish to be able to maintain a certain playfulness where you can feel alive through sex, those are universal. And it was no different in Turkey than it would have been in Argentina. But of course in Turkey, when I had an experience of a coming out of a gay couple in the middle of an auditorium, I was told this is a historical moment, and I knew it was. Whereas when the Argentinians would ask me nonstop questions about female infidelity, I understood that this is at this point probably the question through which one can look at how the macho status quo is finally being challenged.
Well, wait, let's slow that down a little. In Argentina, in South America, the primary question is about female infidelity.
When I say primary, it means that there is a moment when you've met 25 journalists and every single one of them has asked you one question that keeps coming back, and you know that the country you just did last week didn't have that question.
So, and it means when you see that the journalists are all asking you about female infidelity, is it that they're afraid of it? What is it? What is it that you're seeing in this?
It is the male privilege being taken away because monogamy was an imposition on women by a patriarchal society that needed to know who gets the cows, and it's about patrimony and economy, and that allowed men to actually experience, a certain home life and passion on the outside. Passion existed, but it was a male privilege that took place elsewhere. And for the woman to claim that is a kind of challenge, not even a kind, it is an overt challenge to the established order and to the established power structure that has existed so far. She's finally independent enough economically, and she's finally able to claim enough and not fear that her whole life will be ruined and her reputation, etc., etc., that she now too, on occasion, for a host of reasons of her own, may find herself no more faithful, sexually faithful, than him.
Mm-hmm. Well, I offer you another possible explanation, which is that in every society there is the head baboon and then there are the subordinate monkeys. And the subordinate monkeys never get a chance to get the females that the head baboon gets. So maybe their question is really, are all those women now available to me? Do you know what I mean? Maybe the question by the reporters is that, hey, women are doing infidelity. That means I have more access to them, as opposed to, is it my woman that's having the infidelity? Because especially if you're a reporter as opposed to a writer, you're probably not in the top group. You're probably in the secondary group. Well, what would be the fascination of people, like, for example, in Sweden? What are they most fascinated with?
Well, Sweden was very interesting because the chapter that they were most interested in, like the French, was the chapter in my book that is called Democracy versus Hot Sex. And it's a chapter that basically looks at the unanticipated consequences of the egalitarian model on couples' desire. And, you know, Sweden is probably one of the more egalitarian societies, structurally speaking, that we have at this point. There is extensive maternity leave. There is mandatory paternity leave. There is a real framework put in place whereby one can almost see a kind of an interchange between men and women. And so then the question of the Swedish have a term that is called a soft man. You know, what happens to that soft man vis-a-vis sexuality and vis-a-vis the desire?
Is a soft man a good man? Is that the mush man?
Yes, it's a mush man. He's good, but he's basically become so emotionally attuned and so sensitive that he has lost his testosterone. Basically.
And so he's like
stripped
our
of aggression.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's stripped of aggression in the sense of the propulsivity of aggression. We're not even talking about, you know, there's no talk about violence, but the kind of the testosterone drive. He's stripped of competition. He's stripped of drive. He's stripped of fearlessness. He's stripped of the traditional
aggression.
Yes.
All of those things. Stripped of meaning that he no longer uses. I mean, he may have stripped himself.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes.
He may have taken off his armor to put down his sword and his head.
To play with the boys and the girls in the sandbox.
That's all. I don't want to be that anymore.
Right.
Right? And
yes.
Now, who is concerned about these people? Are the Swedish men concerned about
yes,
these men?
Yes, both. The man says, you say you want, the man says to the woman, you said you want this man, but then you go and you have sex with another man. It ain't me.
So how come?
Because there is something that desire needs difference, I think. Desire needs separateness. And when two people become too much the same, interchangeably the same, and when you kind of take the interchange of roles and tasks as becoming almost an interchangeable gender, then it really saps desire.
Armand Miller with Esther Perel. Esther,
Is that clear?
Yeah. And I'm going to push that a step further. Therefore, if two people have hot, torrid sex all the time, where it's really on fire and they're two Argentinians or two, you know, whatever it is, then you're going to say that one or the other of them is going to be attracted to a mushier person, a softer person?
No.
Because you think hot sex kind of fills the bill.
No, I think that nobody has hot sex all the time. I think that we have to be really realistic. But I think that to have an intensity in sex, there needs to be otherness. And the problem, and otherness means this way. You know, desire is not really politically correct sometimes. Why don't people talk about sex? They don't talk about sex because they also don't like talking about what they think about while they have sex. And if what they were thinking about was a bed of roses, they would have no problem talking about it. But our erotic mind is a lot more, you know, a lot less docile and a lot more rebellious and a lot more animalistic and a lot more wild and a lot less politically correct. And those are the parts of desire that are the hardest to bring home to the person that you love and that you respect.
But, you know, many women see things like pornography as exploitive, and if a man really, you know, many men enjoy pornography, and all the men I know who talk about it say they do it in private, they don't want to get caught, they don't want their wife to see them. So they kind of, what's happening is a kind of division where they're taking their real erotic hot mind, which may be related to internet porn or television porn, and they're keeping that in the closet somewhere. That's a secret. And the women are saying, because that is exploitive and that's no good, do you think it's affecting the relationships? Do you think that a woman should allow or share a man's desire for watching erotica?
Oh, that's a very big question. First of all, I would like to make the distinction between watching porn and being addicted to porn. I think it's two very different things. I think culturally speaking, you will find many women in Europe who are quite tolerant towards men watching porn. Partly because they don't have the sense that the man should be only into her. They fully understand that she's also into others. And they don't just take this romantic ideal that if we are everything for each other, nobody else should be still entering our radar screen to the letter. They understand the spirit of the idea, but not the kind of specificity of it. The next thing I would say is that, you know, what's interesting for many men, the ones that I often work with, is to understand what is it that they find when they go online, you know. And I'm talking about the broad center here, not the people on the fringes. What they find online is very sexual, let's talk about straight men, sexual, voracious, greedy women who constantly say more, 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 me too, and they never have a headache, they have no psychology and no history. And with that kind of woman, you can let go. And it often is actually the very man who is so caring and loving and responsible and worried and attentive to his partner who needs that space where they can bring that other side of desire that they don't feel they can bring with their partner. And the ones who can often will be, in my experience, much less needing to go and have that other place where they can experience another side of their sexuality.
So you're saying, in effect, that men are using erotica, pornography, if it's not an addiction, which it may be, but they're using it to kind of feel themselves alive. And you're saying...
No, not just alive. To experience the aggressive side of sex that they cannot bring to the person that they love and respect.
But isn't it for themselves to experience
yes,
it, and whether or not it's for the other person?
No, it's for themselves. It's totally selfish.
I mean, what I'm beginning to hear is that very often men's infidelity, sex, pornography, and all of that is about is about a fear of death. Well, I'll put it there.
Yeah.
If we say that on one side we have a man who feels like, well, now I'm responsible, now I have a baby, now I have a house, now I have a job, and then there's got to be some place in the world where I feel alive. And not responsible and not that. And that a lot of that other sexual attraction has to do with a man's feeling himself kind of trapped and ensnared. And women, too. I mean, we can go on the other side of it.
Yes, because, you know, until today, most sexuality in long-term relationships was either of wifely duty or based on 12 kids. This is the first time in history that we are asking people to sustain desire for a long time, and we live twice as long with the same person.
Ah.
And to do it not because they have to, but because they want to, and they happen to want it at the same time.
How do you keep your partner that stimulated for so many years, for so long?
Because you don't keep them stimulated in the bedroom. You keep people engaged in everything that's outside of the bedroom. That makes a relationship interesting, that makes people interesting and interested, that maintains a sense of curiosity, of discovery, of a kind of a project of life where people still have a lot of things they want to do together. It's that where the aliveness comes. And that enters. It can be intellectual, it can be social, it can be playful, it can be sport, nature, art. And all of those things come to create the erotic in the bedroom.
Because without the erotic, what is life?
Look, one definition of eroticism is that's the cultivation of pleasure for its own sake. And if you look at it from the mystical sense, it is about a quality of aliveness, of vibrancy, and of exuberance. It's the antidote to death. Modernity narrowed the meaning of eroticism by making it strictly sexual.
The antidote to death.
And why is it sexual? That's why the French call orgasm the little death, because there is something in the act of sex when it is good, where you can feel yourself alive like no other.
This is Armand DeMille. My guest is Esther Perel. The name of the book is Mating in Captivity, with many subtitles from different parts of the world, including Dribbling Down Your Chin. I like that. I really love that. South America. Hey, this is WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial here in New York, and it's just about 1:30. We're going to take a short musical break, and when we come back, we're going to continue with Esther Perel. This is fabulous stuff. Here's a little gift for you, my friends. Actually, here's a little gift for you also, Esther. Here we go.
Nuit d'hiver, tout est silence, terre et ciel. Le désert, lui, loin de la mer, tout en bas du mont Saint-Michel. Sommet, j'avale un vent muet, grisant comme un vin de Toscane. Mon regard plonge dans la baie, je vois passer la caravane. Ils sont bien 50, les chameaux, les gens, sous la lune errante, là, se balançant. Le rythme royal me charme et m'appelle. Volant, je dévale les longues ruelles. Doux comme un miroir, je cours vers eux tout en criant. Ils passent sans me voir, détachés sur le ciel d'argent. Seul, un homme au regard embrasé, fier comme un prince d'Erevan, me tend une rose embaumée. Et il rejoint la cabane. Je reste figé dans ma peau terminée.
Brigitte Fontaine, La Caravane.
Vers ma limousine, je pose la rose sur le siège avant.
And this is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. And we have in the studio with us today the very exciting, very smart Esther Perel. Unlocking erotic intelligence, you know? Or a man's brain is in his penis. No, that's not erotic intelligence, is it?
No.
No. In fact, it's the opposite. What, Esther Perel, come on, you're so outrageous, and I know you're leaving the country tonight so that if people come after you, they can't catch you. Why do people have affairs?
Oh, my God. For a host of reasons, people stray. I mean, people stray because they want to resist the confinements of marriage, and people stray because they want to beat back a sense of deadness that has crept into their life.
Well, what do you mean, escape the confinements of marriage, even if it's not marriage, even if they're couples, you know, relationships.
Yeah. Because sometimes relationships, you know, become surveillance systems.
What do you mean?
Meaning that people feel that they have no freedom, that they have no say sometimes, that they have no sense of power, that they have no sense of themselves anymore, that they, in order to maintain the unit, they have had to compromise chunks of themselves to a degree that feels suffocating to
well,
them.
Well, very often men try to...
I'm not justifying this.
I know, I understand. I mean, kind of the way you see it. But very often a woman, for example, if she sees a man who might be flirtatiously attracted to another woman, mm-hmm. she jumps in there and she starts, you know, with the justification and, you know, all kinds. What?
Her man.
Her man. Mm-hmm. If her man is attracted to somebody else, boy, she could jump right in there. And instead of saying, I'm jealous, she'll say, well, you see, this is no good for you because this is what you're doing and this is what you're going to do to this person and so on and so forth. Or if she sees him attracted to something else, it's almost like the belief is if I constrain you enough, I'm going to keep you. And that's a very American concept that doesn't seem to work too well, does it?
Well, look, you're asking two different things, right? One is how do people secure loyalty and exclusivity? And the fact that for most couples, monogamy is not just a matter of emotional loyalty and commitment, but it is very much seen as a matter of sexual exclusivity, sexual faithfulness. But there are plenty of models where actually the emotional commitment becomes separated from the sexual exclusivity. That is where a lot of other couples are trying to go. All of them are trying one thing, to preserve the relationship. Those who choke and those who open the gates and everybody in between have one purpose, making it last, making it work. There is nobody in this that is actually disillusioned and anti-couple. Now,
Wait a minute. So that's a very interesting
thing. You understand? Open
jealousy, even jealousy can be perceived as an attempt to preserve.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Right? It's and not just a controlling effort. It's like an attempt to preserve. I want to preserve what I have.
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly. But sometimes, in order to preserve what I have, I resort to certain controlling tactics. But jealousy is so much more than just an experience in control. Jealousy is a fear of loss. Jealousy is a sense of diminishment of oneself. Jealousy is about the uncertainty of love. The fact that even though you are with me, you don't belong to me, and I can at any moment also lose you. And jealousy in many ways is, in small doses, is actually very powerful and very useful in many couples, because it kind of lets people, it reminds people that you could never become too complacent and never take the other person for granted, and that there is a certain element of uncertainty in love that is intrinsic to it and that is crucial for desire. That's number two. There's a little bit of fear that actually fuels desire in the way that love can't stand it, but desire needs it. And then there is the question you ask about why people stray. People stray for a host of reasons. They can be rebellious. They can sometimes just not have resisted something that came on to them. They can have been rejected for too long. They can have felt very disempowered and invisible in a relationship. Sex is a component of infidelity, but it is not the prime, necessarily, the prime component. And of course, in all infidelity, there is the experience of also betraying the trust for those people who had never actually negotiated the fidelity, but just assumed it. And that often becomes much bigger than what actually was done. It's the violation of trust. That is what people talk about when they talk about infidelity, more than anything else.
I want to be safe with you, is primarily what they're asking for. But you say that in Europe, there's not as much emphasis put on this, the man not straying or the woman not straying.
See, I think that what happens in some European and South American countries, actually, is not that people have a different model and a different ideal, but that they are less idealistic about it. They understand reality. They wish it wasn't like that, but they also are not going to necessarily destroy the whole relationship and the whole family because of it. Sex is important, but maybe not that important. You know, you can have monogamy today is not one partner for a whole lifetime. Today, monogamy is one partner at a time. And Americans have a tendency of going from one partner to the other and using infidelity often as the gateway out of the relationship, rather than sometimes understanding that infidelity can do a lot of very strange things to a relationship, which is sometimes even to actually stabilize it. Sometimes people have an affair because they want to make their marriage last. That sounds crazy, but it actually is not unthought. Sometimes people think that it will allow them to accept what they have better. And of course, it's not, you know, if you take the traditional model and if you go into the moral realm, you can have a lot of arguments with this. But you have to understand that this is not black and white, and this is often by people who are not unaware of what goes on. I would say that in order to stray, there must be something really compelling on the other side that makes you want to destroy or put at risk what is so dear to you. It's rarely just light.
So there must be some kind of desperation that you feel. If a woman is feeling in a relationship with a husband or with somebody who is, like, oppressive to her, she would take this feeling and say, and then she looks on the outside.
Stop.
There's a part of, yes?
No. Because you instantly, by the way you ask your question, imply that infidelity is always the result of the dynamic in the couple.
Great.
What if I said to you, she could be oppressed with a man who is utterly not oppressive? That there is something in the life that she has that is stifling her completely, and that it is not in response to what the other person does. Sometimes infidelity has nothing to do with the partner. That's also another
good.
One of
Go
those
there.
Thoughts.
Go there.
You know, it has to do with something that we are feeling inside of us.
Like, there's a part of me that just has. I remember one man I knew who said, I refuse to buy cable. And I said, why do you refuse to buy cable television? He said, because I don't want to watch television, because I don't want to watch, become someone who watches television. He says, I could never do that. He says, I'm afraid of that part of me, to become that person who sits at home and watches television. And it's that very same man who feels that a desire, a drive elsewhere towards something outside of his marriage. It's like sometimes you just feel trapped inside yourself, and it has little to do with your
Absolutely.
Relationship. So not all infidelity is cured or dealt with by couples counseling. Sometimes it has nothing to do with couples counseling.
Correct. Correct.
So you do that, right? You do couples counseling. You work with couples, and you do usually people come to you because you're a sex expert. They want to improve their sex life. But you watch and you see that very often what looks like a sexual problem is really a problem of some kind of feeling about yourself.
Right. I am a couples therapist first who works on areas of sexuality. I would put it reverse. And I would say, look, sometimes it's important to tell the other person, this is not about you. And not only that, the person who has been straying has actually strayed from a relationship that they're quite content with. When I'm saying this, I'm not denying all the other explanations that have been given all along. I just think that there is more to the story. It's very easy to just see it as it happens to people who are miserable, to people who are in reaction to something vis-à-vis their own partner. No, I think it happens in a host of sometimes unmeditated ways. It's not always that people go out looking for it. And sometimes they find something they didn't even know existed, sometimes inside themselves. And sometimes, as the result of an uncovering of an infidelity, couples can engage with each other in a kind of conversation, exchange, depth, that is more alive than what they have felt in the last 10 years of their relationship, even though it is excruciatingly painful. And sometimes, because they suddenly can face losing it all, they experience for the first time their desire to reclaim it all, sexually as well. And so affairs have a very strange and multiple effects on a relationship. Sometimes it kills it off, whatever little was left, but sometimes it actually becomes an extremely invigorating, even though not chosen, event in a couple's life.
What do you do if you see your mate straying? I mean, do you actually sometimes wonder if your mate is straying because is it something to do with us or is it something to do with you? And if you had the courage to address that question with your mate, it would be kind of wonderful, wouldn't it?
Look, I think that there's so many different things. Sometimes you take it on directly with your partner, and sometimes you say nothing and you actually try to bring your partner back to you. And there are people who are able to act in silence without ever doing the open confrontation that are admirable, that just kind of take the whole thing on and wait. Sometimes people wait. Sometimes people decide to not bring this out in the open. Sometimes they just go right after and want all the details about everything that happened to a degree that is probably not necessarily so good for them, because the other person is already sleeping fine and they are still up at night awake and going through all the details. They have been overexposed, if you want, like in a traumatic event. So here in this culture, there is a sense that that honesty is about putting all the facts on the table, and not necessarily about maintaining people's face and honor, which is in the view of honesty in many other cultures.
Well, wait, let's go with that. Maintaining face and honor. You must allow a person to maintain their honor?
You know, when the French are talking about infidelity, one of the first things they always talk about is about how the most important thing is to not be indiscreet and not to have the other person find out. Not because you don't want them to know what you're doing, but because you don't want them to suffer the humiliation of knowing. The whole idea is if you're going to do something, you do it in a way where it doesn't humiliate, hurt the other person. And it's from these shores, when you think like that, it seems completely convoluted.
It does seem convoluted, but I understand at the same time. So really,
you know, I'm a cross-cultural psychologist. I try to enter into the mind of people who think about these things as openly as I can, to really understand the logic that sometimes makes perfect sense in one place and seems completely blatantly out of whack in another environment.
What's happening to masculinity and femininity? Here we are so many years after the feminist movement has begun, and here we are finally having made some strides. What do you think is happening to this whole identity of masculinity and femininity?
Look, I think, feminism has made some strides, but we are far from done. And anytime we act as if it's over and we no longer need it, I think that we are quite misguided. I don't think women have equal power. I don't think women have less dangers to face at this point. I think that they still have incurred far more wounds than men will, and so forth. However, there is a sense today that there is no longer a singular identity. There isn't one femininity and there isn't one masculinity. And I think that once we can at least think about it in the plural, that there are masculinities and that sometimes you can have more than one in the course of your lifetime in one person also. The same way that there isn't one sexuality. We all will experience numerous different sexualities in the course of our lifetime. That is a given today. And once we can create these more fluid models, then the main requirement is for people to be flexible. The problems will occur each time people go rigid.
What is masculinity?
You know, it's very interesting. There's a sentence that came back to me as I'm preparing for this show in Paris, where from a book I once read, that women are born women, men become men. There is no rituals in any traditional society almost where women have to go out to prove their femininity, whereas men are constantly in every traditional culture having to go to prove that they are now becoming men, that they are leaving the feminine inside of them, that they are repudiating that part of themselves, and that they can go into the woods and become tough and strong and fearless and all of that.
So boyishness and boyish youth is considered the feminine.
Yes.
Identification.
Yes.
And that the man has to go through a transition to become the male.
Right.
Right,
and he has to go through a transition where he actually rejects those other parts of him so that his masculinity is predicated on his not being woman. And I think there's something extremely rigid in this, you know, this idea that there is masculine and feminine. There are traits of both floating around and swimming inside people at this point, and they interchange, and we will probably do much better when we come up with something a little bit more androgynous or fluid and plural than when we stay in this kind of one, you know, what is man is what is not female. That means strong, powerful, fearless, competitive, aggressive, testosterone, not weak, not scared, not too mush, not too soft, not too emotional, no tears, all of these kind of harsh definitions that basically truncate people. I have two boys, and, you know, when they start out not that different from the girls.
But you're also saying that in order to reawaken sexuality between couples, you want a man to reclaim that part of himself that they've often negotiated away. You think that men have given up too much of their masculinity, don't you?
No, the Swedes think that.
No, you don't think that?
Not every time. I think in some couples I do, and in some couples I think that we could lessen the testosterone.
I mean, don't you think some of the way of not lessening, because it's not testosterone to grab your woman, if you're somebody who wants to grab a woman, and you take your woman and you make love to her in a much more directive way than if in the past, you know, that you take control of the situation. Mm-hmm. Now that is a masculine approach.
Right.
As opposed to the other approach, which is to sit and wait and see if the candle is lit so that maybe now is the appropriate time.
Right.
Don't you strongly recommend, if I remember right in your audio tapes and in your book, that a man take control of the situation every now and then?
See, I don't think of it in terms of control. I think that when you talk about desire, there is an energy in the verb. There
Good.
Is a force in desire. If love is about wanting, if love is about having, desire is about wanting. And in order to want, you need to be able to go out there and take grab, pursue, conquer, and then bring it closer to you. And when women talk about being desired, you know, their desirability often goes hand in hand with the forcefulness with which he approaches her, not in violent ways, in insistency, in I want you so much and I can't resist you, makes her feel quite desirable. It's that dance, you know? And so when he waits, there is a sense that it's very hard to let go with someone that doesn't feel to you as strong. It's not about control, it's about strong. It's about present. It's that, it's about solid, you know?
And it's about the energy, which is what you're saying. So if the energy is not present in the room, if it's kind of flaccid...
Then it's flat. Then it's flat.
Flaccid is flaccid.
Yes.
You know, I was trying to think the other day, somebody came up with the question, is there another use for the word ejaculate other than sexual?
Do you know?
No, I don't know. Do you know?
No.
Never heard. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind with Esther Perel. So a man is trying to be a man by some identification that almost doesn't work anymore. What is the new man going to be like? Is it going to be the metrosexual?
I think the biggest change, the biggest wonderful change that men have been able to experience, and that I've seen worldwide, is fatherhood. I mean, the change of the definition of fatherhood, the new father, the father that is not in control, authoritarian, disciplinarian, but a father that can actually have a full relationship with his children, is probably the biggest change to masculinity and manhood that has occurred, you know, in most countries. And from there, you want to reconcile that father with his manhood, the same way that women have had to reconcile their motherhood with the womanhood.
Well, how do women react to watching it? Yes, I know what you're talking about, because I know a lot of young people now who have babies, and you watch the men with the babies, and you say, you know, when I was a kid, no father would have treated his baby like that. They hold the babies, they rock the babies, they change the babies, they do all of that, and they do it with great love, and they appreciate it. It's almost like they're allowed to. But what's the cost of that? Does that cost on a sexual level in your relationship with your wife? Does it become like, you know, well, you've taken my role as a man, you've now taken some of my woman's role with the baby, and therefore I don't feel as connected to you sexually because you're not as much of a man. You're now like a mother to my child. Do you think it's had the cost?
Mm.
Because I'm seeing among the couples where that's present that there is less sexuality between them, less sexual energy between them. It's almost like you've got your grandmother taking care of the child with you as well.
See, I would put it to you in different terms. I think the issue is this. When you create a family model that is egalitarian, that is based on democratic principles, that has interchangeable roles and all of that, and that is very much a peer companionate model, you create best friends. You create people who end up feeling with each other comfortable, cozy, warm, loving in the family. The problem is that you don't bring lust in the family.
So
that's what stops.
Yes, okay.
Is that you have created an environment that answers a whole set of rich needs, but it so happens that those very needs, when they are met, they end up producing something that is powerfully anti-erotic.
So if it's anti-erotic, how do you change it? How do you make it uncle erotic?
By knowing that the rules of the kitchen are not the same as the ones in the bedroom. That by developing a whole flexibility, by being able to step out of these roles. You know, mom and dad sex was never meant to be hot sex. This is something very difficult that we're trying to do. You know, and you don't solve it with 10 quick steps and techniques and sex toys. All of these can help. But
it does require a consciousness, Esther, and I think what you're doing is bringing some attention to it. Yes, there may be a cost to this. Yes, we are developing in the right direction. Yes, men are now allowed to be true fathers to their children, which may be that they're fathers, which is a combination of father and mother, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they're mothers, you know? Maybe there's something else. But they're being allowed that for the first time. And there may be a reaction to the woman on the inside as she watches her baby being practically suckled by her husband. And this reaction may have its course, but it's worth talking about, worth bringing it out in the open. And what you say is, and keep in mind, in the bedroom, it's not necessarily the same thing. Maybe bringing the baby into the bed is not a good idea. You know, people sleep with their baby between them all the time. Well,
that's a big cultural one also.
What do you mean?
Because the rules of children in the bedroom are very, very varied, actually, across cultures. And the issue of the child in the bedroom, you can't take it in isolation. The problem is that the child who's in the bedroom is also the child who interrupts you a lot, is also the child who is no longer getting frustrated, is also the child who gets parents to spend their entire weekend at the fields watching him play and no longer have time to be alone as adults. And so it's part of a larger model. We tend to take, you know, the bed as the kind of symptom of it all. It's a whole culture of child rearing that has basically made it so that the erotic energy has been redirected onto the kids. People play with the kids. They bring novelty to the kids. They dress their kids in the latest fashions. They have languorous hugs with the kids. And the couple survives like a, you know, with a diet of quick peck like a cactus. It's errors redirected. That's the problem of the child model. The child in the bed in itself is not an issue. There are plenty of cultures where children sleep in the bedroom with their parents. It's the larger story where this unprecedented child centrality has basically left couples with very little for themselves. And unfortunately, families only survive if the couples are happy.
Esther Perel, fabulous. Mating in Captivity, the book, it just came out in its paperback edition. I want to thank you so much for being with us. Probably we could talk for hours and hours and hours. Thank you so much for being back with us again.
Thank you.
Is there a website, Esther, by the way?
Yes, EstherPerel.com.
Esther Perel, E-S-T-H-E-R-P-E-R-E-L.com. I guess that's where you'll find her.